We are very lucky today. We have Peter Blexley with us, who is going to talk to us a little bit about some of the work that he's done. Peter, do you want to just give us a little bit of an introduction and tell us your bit about your background?
Certainly. I was an errant youth back in the day, the product of a one-parent family after my alcoholic and abusive father had cleared off. And I just went a little bit off the rails, to be perfectly frank with you. As a kid, I didn't go to school very often, which remains a matter of deep regret because life would have been easier with a decent education behind me. And my dear mum, who is remarkably still with us, realised that I needed a bit of straightening out, to be perfectly frank. And so one night I came home from my job as a 16-year-old warehouseman, and to my horror, there was an enormous uniformed cop sitting in our lounge of the flat that I shared with my mum. And, of course, my first thought was, oh, shit, what am I going to get nicked for? But as good fortune would have it, he was there to give me a bit of careers advice. And after a couple of hours, he had thoroughly sold the idea to me of joining the police cadets, so much so that he'd brought the application forms with him that I duly filled out and stuck in the post the following day. A few short weeks later, I walked through the gates of the Metropolitan Police Cadet Training College at Hendon with a haircut, and my life was transformed, to be perfectly frank. I suddenly thrived on discipline instead of resenting it. And then when I was 18 and a half, I became a fully fledged police constable, and then got posted to Peckham in southeast London, the really, really mean streets of Peckham, and they were. Did 4 years there, then became a detective in Kensington and Chelsea, the Royal Borough, you know, where there was a rather different type of crime, criminal and victim. Did all that. And then I wanted to be a Scotland Yard detective. That was the next natural step for me. I was very fortunate, got onto the Central Drug Squad, so I was a part of that failed and pointless war on drugs. But at the time, we thought we were doing the right thing. I worked undercover for 10 years, buying guns, drugs, buying millions upon millions of pounds worth of drugs, counterfeit currency, stolen goods, high value, stolen goods, all that kind of stuff. Professed to be a gun for hire, an assassin. So if somebody wanted someone murdered, I'd rock up and say, I'm your man. And so they'd later find themselves arrested for conspiracy to murder, all that kind of stuff. And then, unfortunately, my identity got compromised through the theft of a report and a plot that the FBI discovered to murder me on a phone tap that they had in a bar in Boston, Massachusetts, parachuted into the witness protection program. Two miserable, horrible years doing that, living in constant fear of the assassin's bullet, conspiracy theorising as to how the report ever got written, let alone taken out of a police station and then stolen from a car, and basically drank too much, smoked too much, had a catastrophic mental breakdown, admitted to a lock-in psychiatric ward where I spent 3.5 weeks, and that really signified the end of my police career. So at the age of 40, I was largely on the scrap heap of life, no education to call upon, no skill, no trade, no calling, nothing like that. All I'd known was policing. And so I wrote my autobiography, The Gangbuster. Very fortunate to get a contract to publish that. That did all right, propelled me into the media. So I went from living a secretive life to a life in the public eye. And I've kind of scratched a living there ever since for the last 20 years. Written 4 books, 3 plays for Radio 4, countless radio and television appearances, commentating on crime and policing and other matters like that. I suppose the gig that sprung me to greater prominence than anything was when I was the chief on Channel 4's show called Hunted. I did 6 series of that, four of the main series and 2 of the celebrity versions. Before on my final series, we caught all the fugitives, which was a wonderful, wonderful day, the culmination of some brilliant investigation work. And by that time, coupled with the fact that I just about had a belly full of it, I quit. And now I'm full-time investigative writer and broadcaster.
Fantastic. Well, Peter, I think it's fair to say that you've probably had a very, very, very colourful life, and you've probably got a few interesting stories to tell over a pint or two.
Yes.
Absolutely. So, but one of the main reasons that we are keen to talk to you today is because episode 21 of our podcast covered the case of Alistair Wilson, who was obviously the banker from Nairn who was shot dead on his doorstep. Now, the murder is still unsolved, and there's been a recent appeal again by one of his sons to get more information and bring the culprit to justice. And I believe that you investigated this case, Peter. So I wonder if you can talk to us about that today.
Happily. In 2005, on the one-year anniversary of Alistair's murder, which took place on the 28th of November 2004, on the one-year anniversary, I was asked by an esteemed BBC journalist in Scotland, a guy called James Shaw, who can still be heard on the radio and seen on our screens broadcasting from your great nation, which I love. James asked me if I would be willing to travel up to Nairn, stay there for a few days and look into this case. Now, I'd already been made aware of the case because it received such enormous publicity back in the day, because of course it was a murder that really didn't fit the profile of Nairn, for example, this beautiful seaside town overlooking the Moray Firth that has a population of 10,000 people, 11,000 if you factor in the outlying areas, and is utterly unused to murder of any sort, let alone somebody being shot dead in an assassination-style killing on their front doorstep, which is more akin, perhaps, to Glasgow or Manchester or London or Birmingham or Liverpool or any of our other kind of cities. So that was fascinating. And also the fact that Alistair very much did not fit the profile of somebody that would be the victim of such a crime. This 30-year-old banker, father of two, lives a very kind of, dare I say it, a sort of middle Scotland, middle England kind of life, if you will. So when the BBC asked me to go up there and comment on the crime twice a day, for BBC Radio 5 Live, I jumped at the chance, flew up there. James met me at the airport. We went to the hotel, which was rather nice, by the way. BBC budgets wouldn't stretch to a hotel like that these days, let me tell you. Very nice hotel just outside of Nairn. And for 3 days on the trot, we did a live piece either from the scene of the crime or somewhere else that was of relevance. And we broadcasted to the morning show on 5 Live, which was then hosted by Victoria Derbyshire. And then we broadcasted to the drive time show. And shame on me, I can't remember who the presenter was then. So twice a day for 3 days. And me and James just threw ourselves into it. You know, of course, as I've said, I was already aware of it, but the more I rooted around over the 4 or 5 days we were there, I just became utterly fascinated and convinced that this was a case that could and should be solved. There were so many potential lines of inquiry which should have come to fruition. And the case never left me. It still hasn't left me. So I returned back to London after I had done this, utterly fascinated by the crime. And I spent quite a bit of time and effort trying to get television involved, because I felt there was like a local BBC Scotland documentary done on it, but the case never received and still hasn't, shamefully, received the real kind of widespread mainstream broadcast attention that it needs in documentary terms. That is, you know, yeah, news, it gets thrown up, you know, every anniversary and what have you, but it's never really had a dominate the screen, 9 o'clock documentary series done about it. And it should. Anyway, I have a mate of mine who at the time was a young up-and-coming sort of producer-director. And we pitched via a production company to Channel 4 for a small budget to do a half an hour documentary. But I thought that was better than nothing. At least it would be on a national station rather than a regionalized Scottish station. So we traveled back up to Nairn. By this time, we'd fast forwarded to about 2009. And again, spent some time up there, rekindling relationships that I'd established when I went up there way back in 05, keeping in touch with people, letting people know that whilst I was out of sight, Alistair's murder certainly wasn't out of mind for me. And I kept chipping away. Channel 4's lawyers bottled it with regards to that documentary because I basically wanted to ask awkward questions, questions that their lawyers were too afraid of, shall we say. Because back then, my thoughts weren't perhaps quite as, not finalized, but as refined perhaps as they are now. I, like many, many people at the time in 2009, was asking questions of Alistair's wife, Veronica, not literally, but in my head. And in fact, still, if you go to Nairn today, and you walk into a pub and have a drink and tell people what you're doing or just spark up a conversation about Alistair, you will unfortunately find people that will, without one shred of any evidence whatsoever, they'll go, it's the wife. It's something to do with the wife. The wife's got something to do with it. And it's just based on idle gossip. No substance to that whatsoever.
Why do you think they come out with that? What do they think that she had to gain as a result of his death? Because my understanding wasn't she didn't financially gain so much.
Don't believe everything you read in the paper, right? I'm going to unashamedly get the plug in now for my book, To Catch a Killer, which was published in 2018. And it is it's the most authoritative thing that's ever been broadcast or written about the Alistair Wilson murder. And it asks those uncomfortable questions, which quite simply have never been posed or asked. And some of them have been answered in any discussion about the murder, outside perhaps of a police station. So Alistair died in service. Now, I believe you both have some experience of financial services. But I was told, my book was published at the end of 2018, by the way. I was told during the course of my research, which continues into this crime, and people are still very welcome to pick up the phone and talk to me about it, because I would dearly love to see somebody charged with this crime. Alistair died in service. Now, I know he'd handed in his notice and he was going to go and work for the Building Research Establishment, the BRE, but Alistair died in service. And so you get in-service death benefits, which is sometimes 3, 4, 5 times your salary. So that's a bit of a myth.
Yeah, especially if you've been there quite a while. It generally increases with the length of service.
And usually with a bank or whatever, it's usually the default is sort of 4 times your salary.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, to say that Veronica didn't stand the game financially is actually a myth. It's not strictly true. And because of things like this and other matters, if we talk about the blue envelope, for example, and people, if they're wondering what we're talking about, perhaps need to listen to your episode 21, you know, but the blue envelope that Veronica claims Alistair came upstairs with. All right. I'll just do a quick recap. It's just after 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 28th of November, 2004. Alistair and Veronica have bathed the kids. And they're getting them ready for bed. Alistair's reading them a bedside story. Ding dong, the front doorbell goes. An unusual thing to occur on a late November night at that time on a Sunday in Nairn. And Alistair and Veronica thought it was unusual, but nonetheless, Alistair went to answer the door. Another thing that people haven't said is that Alison and Veronica very rarely used their front door. Everybody went round the back because they had a driveway to the side. If you look at the house, it's on the left, the driveway. Everybody went round the back. They very rarely used the front door. Anyway, Alistair goes there, answers the front door, has a conversation with a man, and then goes back upstairs to Veronica, and he's holding this famed blue envelope, the type you get with a greetings card, with the name Paul on it. There's a conversation between Alistair and Veronica about that envelope before Alistair sadly returns back down to the front door. Now, Veronica is the only person on earth that talks about this blue envelope, of course. Nobody else saw it. Well, if it existed, Alistair is dead, rest his soul. And of course, the gunman escaped and must have taken that blue envelope with him. There is utterly no other explanation for the fact, because when Alistair comes down to the front door, the three shots are heard, which, as you said rightly in your pod, Veronica thought sounded like the sounds of wooden pallets hitting the ground. She runs downstairs to find her husband lying across the threshold of the front door, prone, mortally wounded. She becomes hysterical, understandably so. But so because of, like, he dies in service, she may have benefited. The blue envelope, her testimony, her demeanour on the rare occasions that she's been interviewed in the media, and other factors, people still point the finger at Veronica. Now, I'll fast forward a little bit, if I may. I'll skip through the numerous trips that I've made to Nairn in the ensuing years, because you imagine, when you're writing a book on a crime like that, and you're almost using it as an appeal notice, you have to spend a lot of time developing sources. If you've read the book, you know, the interviews, that some of which are anonymized, that the people gave me, the trust that I earned from people so that they would tell me stuff that quite simply has never been out there in regards to Alistair's murder, ever before or since. It takes time to gain that trust, to build those relationships so that people feel comfortable in telling you stuff that they haven't told any other living soul. So we then fast forward. The book's published, end of 2018. I'm on the publicity trail for the book, if you will. You know, the media interviews, the radio, the TV, all that kind of stuff, which is very much a part of writing a book. And, I'm a frequent contributor to the Jeremy Vine radio show on BBC Radio 2. In fact, I carry the title of the Radio 2 policeman. Which doesn't come with a warrant card, any salary, pension rights, firearm, taser, nothing like that, unfortunately. So I was, you know, obviously talking about Alistair, the crime, promoting the book. And not long after I'd finished on Jeremy's show, a man contacted me, told me his name, and I was able to verify who he was and all of that. And it turns out that he was a retired detective chief inspector from the Metropolitan Police. And now I knew that the Northern Constabulary, because that was the name of the police force that carried out the initial investigation into Alistair's murder. At the time, it was called the Northern Constabulary. It is now part, of course, of a national police force in Scotland called Police Scotland. But at the time, that local, regional, piddly-arse little police force, if I might say so, you know, had the responsibility for investigating this crime, a crime of which they were utterly unused to investigating. But don't think I'm giving them any wriggle room here, because it doesn't matter, because policing is all about expecting the unexpected. And so people should be trained sufficiently. You know, even if they're not going to experience these things, they should be trained to know how to deal with them in case it happens. So Northern Constabulary, their investigation had been reviewed by Grampian Police. another Scottish police service, which is now all under the police, all part of Police Scotland. Grampian reviewed the Northern Constabulary's investigation after a couple of years, and they were pretty darn critical of the Northern Constabulary's investigation in the early phases. It lacked leadership and direction, or something like that, was the quote. It's all in the book. And they were quite critical about that early part of the investigation. And I'll put some more flesh on the bones about how poor that was in a moment. Anyway, back to when the book's published. Jeremy Vine's show, man contacts me. He's an ex-detective chief inspector from the Metropolitan Police in London. He's retired. And trust me, there's nothing like retirement from the police to loosen an officer's lips. And he said, I was part of a small team that went up to Scotland and also reviewed the investigation. Right. Now, I am all ears at this stage, as you can probably imagine. And I said, oh, right. Yes, please. And tell me, what were the findings of your review? And he said, it was romance or finance. He said, they were the conclusions that we came to. Well, as questionable as the Northern Constabulary's investigation was, spending the amount of time in Nairn that I have done, if there was any kind of illicit affair on behalf of either Alistair or Veronica, even the Northern Constabulary would have found that out, because some people just cannot control their tongues up there. It is a hotbed, a delicious, lovely hotbed of gossip and rumour and scandal mongering and all of that. You've only got to prop the bar up in any one of those lovely, numerous bars in Nairn. Buy yourself a dram or two, buy the barman one, of course, and say, yeah, I'm here to research and write about the Alistair Wilson murder.
They'll tell you anything, no doubt.
Oh, after they've said, oh, the banker. I don't do accents, as you just discovered, right? They'll say, oh, yeah, you mean the banker? Yes, yes, I do, yeah. Yeah. If there was anything to do with romance on behalf of Alistair or Veronica, even the Northern Constabulary would have found that out. It would have been impossible to suppress it. And I'll give you an example of why. On the night of Alistair's murder, at around the time that he was so tragically shot, there was a fire in Nairn. And Nairn's police service, like so many other sort of remote, kind of, you know, out of city type of places, their police service is largely a volunteer, their fire service, sorry, is largely a volunteer fire service. And so in those days, they carried a pager, or a mobile. And when the pager bleeped, they would all drive to their fire station, don their gear and go off and do their heroic stuff. Well, around about the time, yeah, as I've said, of Alistair's murder, there was a fire. So the volunteer fire service are scrambled and they all come from various locations. When the police later investigated mobile phone traffic, it was discovered, shall we say, that a lot of people were in places where perhaps they shouldn't have been on a Sunday night, right? Having their liaisons, shall we say. And a few people, I think, had some very close shaves as a result of that. Because, of course, when they get dragged into the police station to make their statement, oh, so what were you doing at Madam Miggins' house and not at home at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night? Well, officer, you know.
Fighting fires, obviously.
You promised not to tell the wife. You know, there was quite an element of that, I think, for more than one person.
Many heroic acts, I'm sure, were done that night.
Yeah, indeed. So, they'd have found that out. Any kind of infidelity, illicit affair, anything like that, they would have found it out. So that rules out romance. And it leaves only finance. And I've always said it. Alistair's murder is down to money, finance of some description. And I've put in so much effort into trying to find out, you know, and I've put in the book and in various newspapers that I've contributed to what I've been told and what I've tried to corroborate. And I've had great difficulty in doing that. You know, was Alistair's murder connected to the finances of Livingston Football Club? Well, if you go back and look at that period of that club's history, they were on a meteoric rise on the pitch. Utterly astonishing. They came from nowhere to winning cups and competing in European competitions and trying to smash the monopoly of Glasgow Celtic and Glasgow Rangers and trying to change that whole Scottish football order. And succeeded to a certain extent before the bubble burst and they nosedived largely back to where they came from. But, you know, and Livingston, what, 15 miles west of Edinburgh. Alistair worked at Edinburgh for the bank at the time in specialist lending. A football club would very much come under the specialist lending, as I'm told. Did he know secrets about Livingston and their chairman, who was tried and acquitted of crimes, but clearly was a colourful, larger than life character? So many unanswered questions. And, you know, the fact that it was almost an open secret amongst some lawyers in the central belt of Scotland, that area where most people in Scotland live, as to why Alistair got murdered. Fascinating. Really, really fascinating.
We both come from financial services background, obviously, and I in particular have done a lot of work in financial crime. So that was something that just, I don't know, spidey senses were tingling a little bit, I guess. The more that we spoke about it, it just sounds so suspicious and so shady. I don't know, did you find anything out about, you know, how people were saying, oh, he shouldn't have been able to afford the house that he was living in. And, you know, they were living out with their means and all this sort of thing. You know, there's not a lot of information about that. It just seemed a lot of speculation that we've seen.
You need to read my book, Emma,
I
right?
do. I just want a preview.
a surveyor came up with a great statement because number 10 Crescent Road, where Alistair, the family, and where Alistair lived and died, is a substantial two-fronted, three-storied, major property. It's huge for somebody like me. You know, I regard it as a very big house. I think it's got 9 chimneys. So that gives you some kind of indicator as to how many rooms that have got fires in them. And as a surveyor said to me, who knew Alistair, who was a mate of Alistair, said to me, there's no small bills with a big house. And I thought that's a great line. And he knew their financial situation. He is the man that told me, and I declared it exclusively in the book, knew that Alistair was about to put the house on the market, right? Never been mentioned before, right? There were financial worries. Again, it's in the book. In the business banking, well, in the kind of like the loans department, shall we say, where Alistair worked in this small team that went out dealing with small to medium-sized businesses and essentially authorising, sanctioning their loans during that boom time of 2004, which kind of preceded the almighty great financial crash, takes a deep breath and tries not to get too irritated with bankers, bear with me, right? So yeah, Alistair's got the house on the right. Those people on Alistair's team, and of course, there's a long interview in there with Alistair's partner that he worked with, right? His banking partner that he worked with. They could earn an annual bonus of up to 50% of their salary, right? 50%. Now, that's enormous. And of course, it's a great, you know, it's a huge incentive, an incentive perhaps for people to behave rather amorally, shall we say. I'm not making any accusations about Alistair or his team at the moment, but that's a big, big bonus when you can earn up to 50% of your salary. And yet, in the year leading up to Alistair's death, he only earned a fraction of that. So, was he not putting his back into it? Well, no, actually, he was, but he had a really big deal lined up for a very, very big loan, and that didn't come off. And so he was getting disillusioned. And yet, for a man having money issues, he wasn't claiming all his expenses up until the time of his death. Now, why not? You would think that, you know, when every pound's a prisoner, as they so often say up there about people in his circumstances, you would be across your weekly, monthly expenses claim like a rash. But he wasn't.
You wonder if that's maybe an indicator of his mental state at that time, if there was just so much going on, maybe he was overwhelmed, or that is really strange.
Or if his expenses were being covered by someone else, or he didn't have money concerns because he was waiting a big payoff.
Did he have a pot that he could dip into, you know, cash, pound, notes kind of thing? So claiming the exes, concerns about the bonus and all of that weren't as pressing as they were to his other colleagues. Unfortunately, I haven't got the answers to those questions yet, but hopefully I will, or the cops will, one day. You know, and I need to emphasise that. If anybody listening has any information about it, you're very welcome to give it to me and I will anonymously pass it on to the cops, but never lose sight of the fact that you can pick up the phone and speak to Police Scotland or Crime Stoppers. You can do that anonymously yourself if anybody has anything they want to pass on. Likewise, you know, I'm so often a conduit between people that don't want their names known and yet want me to know something or tell me something that they'd like passed on to the authorities. So many unanswered questions. And we've barely touched on the mechanics of Alistair's murder yet, which of course does not make sense.
I'm obsessed in a kind of Agatha Christie style way about the gun and the origins, the possible origins, the reasoning for it being that type of gun. I mean, that is just a rabbit hole you could fall down for weeks.
I have to say, I remember when this case has always fascinated me, because I remember when it happened and I was working in finance at the time it happened. I was working for a large assurance company in Edinburgh, and the case was just so bizarre, and it's been the case, you know, ever since. You know, it's the circumstances of that whole exchange prior to his death just has always left me feeling it just doesn't ring true. The whole exchange to me is just so bizarre. And I struggle to make sense of it.
Well, if you're saying it's not true, you are casting aspersions. And for me, that is another glaring example of why Veronica is utterly uninvolved in her husband's murder. She is innocent because that lady has had to keep regurgitating that story for 16 years. Now, say, for example, you know, I used to profess to be a hired gun, an assassin, right? If I was going off to do a conspiracy to murder undercover job. You know, I have played the role of that assassin. I have discussed murdering people for real, but not for real, if you know what I mean. And I've planned murders, which, of course, I never had any intention of committing. The easiest lie to tell is the one that's closest to the truth, right? Because then it's easy to remember. And I'm not suggesting Veronica's lying in any way, shape or form. But if you are going to tell a lie, merely hypothesizing here to point out the lunacy of anybody accusing Veronica, okay? Right? Why would Veronica develop such an elaborate story, okay, about Alistair going to the front door, being handed a blue envelope with Paul on it, coming back up, having a conversation, going back down, the description of the man, him seen leaving, going to the left towards that bar called the Shambles, as it was, and all of that. Why would you get involved in any of that if you were plotting to murder your husband, right? If you were plotting with someone to murder your husband and you knew he was going to get shot at around 7 o'clock on a Sunday night on his front doorstep, when the doorbell goes, all you do is you say, go and get that, please, darling. They go down at the front door, bang, 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 they're dead. Horror, shock, horror, and it's all over. Why would you develop such an elaborate story about an envelope to in and fro from the door and all of that? Doesn't make any sense at all.
And if you were going to, you'd have some more evidence to support your story so that people wouldn't just automatically be able to question it immediately. So where's the envelope, for example? Yeah, absolutely.
I think the thing for me, I found so bizarre, and I guess it was kind of cleared up a little bit when we covered the case. I always thought that, in my head, I always thought Alistair had answered the front door, had left the front door open and went upstairs to speak to his wife and then went back down. And I thought, why would you leave somebody at the front door like that to go and ask your wife, oh, there's somebody at the front door and I don't know who it is. Did they ask for me by name? And then go back down again. But from doing the research for the case that we covered, it sounded more like he'd answered the door to this person and then shut the door, gone up and then went back down to see if the guy was still there, which made more sense to me.
Yeah, no, that's not what happened. It was always, it appears from what I know, is that Alistair always intended to go back downstairs. Veronica's attitude was a bit like, oh, well, let's leave it for the morning and we'll deal with it then. But Alistair's curiosity got the better of him. You know, and bearing in mind, he's still holding this envelope. So he was drawn back to the front door. But of course, nobody knows verbatim, word for word, what that initial conversation was. There has never been a verbatim, word for word, record of Alistair and Veronica's, albeit Veronica has given her version of events. And of course, we don't know what happened when Alistair returned with the envelope that was never seen again.
This is the thing for me. If it was a straight-up murder and the guy was going to assassinate him regardless, why didn't he just shoot him the first time that he opened the door? What's the deal with the envelope? Was he wanting him to maybe put some money on the envelope? Was there something along those lines? Is that the reason that he went up and then he came back down? It doesn't seem like a straight... It doesn't seem like a straight murder, because surely he would, you know, it seems like there was another way that this could have gone, perhaps, and that's the reason for the conversation, or else surely he would have just killed him automatically when he opened the door.
Excuse me blowing my own trumpet, but I am the first and only person that ever put it out there in the public domain that the government went there to negotiate and not assassinate.
Yeah.
Was prepared to kill, but didn't go there to kill.
Yeah. That's,
you know, that fits perfectly with the circumstances as we know them, that Alistair, you know, is given that envelope. It wouldn't have been big enough to stick very much money in it.
No.
You know, and it still remains the greatest mystery of all of the circumstances around this case, I think, really. You know, and what a ludicrous thing to do if you're a contract killer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that could be a potential treasure trove of forensic evidence.
I mean, I could be mad, but that does not scream contract killer to me. He doesn't seem like he came across particularly menacing or threatening, that Alistair, you know, was in fear for his life, was genuinely concerned to go back to the door to speak to the individual again. That's just the vibe that I take from this. He's thought, this is really weird. He's maybe not wanted to tell Veronica what it's actually about because, you know, like you said, financial reasons that perhaps she wasn't privy to. And then he's gone back and absolutely did not expect to be shot to death. That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, on that whole professional, you know, hit, perhaps your listeners might want to read what Professor David Wilson has said about it over the years. You know, that great Scotsman, emeritus professor of criminology at Birmingham City University, and, dare I say it, my mate. He's a man I absolutely adore. But he has some very interesting thoughts on it, which kind of contradict with a lot of what I have to say about it. Yeah, he talks all about, you know, that particular space on the doorstep and why it's so often, you know, used and chosen as a place to kill someone for some of the obvious reasons, because you know where they're going to be. I mean, crikey, while we're talking about this, you know, the whole, was he the right Alistair Wilson that got shot, right? That the press have kind of asked that question over the years. Well, yes, there was another Alistair Wilson that lived in Nairn, who lived 200 yards away from Alistair, but he was a poor, unfortunate, hapless alcoholic who was harmless apart from to himself, and would appear to have been as utterly unlikely to be assassinated on their front doorstep as Alistair Wilson, the banker. Besides, if you're going to kill someone, you don't kind of look up their name in an old style phone book. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? You don't knock on the door, you know, Alistair Wilson. Oh, just checking I've got the right Alistair Wilson.
Have you got any ID?
About a murder. Yeah. You know what I mean? You get a bit more detail, don't you? And that all falls in line with the he went to negotiate and not assassinate thread that I've been told is it. You know, but I just wish I could get more. The person that gave me that information, that which was, went to negotiate and not assassinate, but was prepared to do so. And it was connected to the finances of the football club. And lawyers and the like in the Central Belt know the reason why he was murdered. Teasingly, tantalizingly, only gave me that. I never got the real, real vital bit.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet. Exactly. Now we're talking. Boom. That's the attitude. Yes, indeed. Absolutely right. Yeah, not yet.
Something unrelated that just came into my mind is I wonder if murderers for hire at the minute are facing a bit of an issue, because it would be much easier to murder someone on their doorstep right now because you know where they are. But think there would be so many more witnesses. That's quite the conundrum.
Yeah, fortunately, you know, contract killers are not as prevalent as some television dramas and movies might have us believe. Okay, thankfully, they are mercifully rare creatures.
I'll start opening my door again. I've not seen my postman in months.
Yeah.
Peter, can I ask, just Emma mentioned it earlier, I mean, obviously, I know that there's certain things that you might want to keep to yourself or that you might want to encourage people to read your book, which I'll get you to recap on at the end of the episode. But if you'd like to, and if you're able to, I wonder what your thoughts are about the handgun, about the gun that was discarded after the murder. Do you have any thoughts on that?
You can see me, but your listeners can't, unfortunately. Okay. In the book, I actually, quite unusually, when I was in Nairn, I'd publicised the fact on one of my numerous trips that I was in Nairn, and I was contacted by somebody who said, my boss wants to meet you, blah, 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 blah. To cut a long story short, within about 12 or 15 hours of agreeing to meet this person, I had one of those Heinel Saul Schlesinger pistols in my hand, right? Which the police would have had you believe in those days were astonishingly rare. Yeah, well, literally 12 hours or so later, I had one in the palm of my hand, right? And it's about the size of this £10, very inexpensive pay-as-you-go hand phone that I'm holding in my hand. Sorry if you can't see it, readers, but if you Google Alistair Wilson's murder, you'll see that the police did a similar thing showing the size of the handgun. It fits in the palm of a man's hand. It fits in a lady's handbag. I was watching Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino movie, the other day with my teenage sons. Remarkable film. And in that, one of the central characters, the lady who ran the cinema, who'd escaped the Nazis in the opening scene, she puts a pistol in her handbag, a little small lady's clutch bag. It's exactly that kind of weapon. In the 21st century, not the weapon of choice for a professional hitman. It's such low velocity. I mean, sadly, it was sufficient to do the job on Alistair.
So it's a weapon of convenience then. It's a weapon that someone's had access to rather than it's, you know, they've not gone out to purchase a weapon that's specifically used for assassination. It's something that they've been able to obtain in a way that wouldn't cast suspicion on them.
Yeah, it's all about concealment. That's the benefit of that weapon. You know, you can have it in your sock. You can have it down your pants. You can have it in you know, very, very discreetly tucked away in a shoulder holster, in a pocket.
Would it have fit inside an envelope?
Would it fit? Yeah, it would. But again, you know, an envelope wouldn't be robust enough to securely carry a firearm. You know, in fact, I was told one story that Nazi officers were presented it on graduation because they could actually put it in their hat, in their under their cap. You know, unfortunately, I never spoke to a Nazi at a second source that story or not. So you'll forgive me. But yeah, I mean, there are many, many anecdotes around that weapon, and it is a tiny little bit of kit which fits into the palm of your hand. All about concealment for me.
So what do you think needs to happen in order to solve this case?
Well, let me say, before I answer that, if I might do, and I don't want to sound like a politician, but I'll tell you by ducking the question, because I'm not, far from it. I'll tell you why I think it remains unsolved now. And you ladies touched very much on this in your episode 21 about Alistair Wilson, about the state of the banking industry at the time. Let's rewind to the end of 2004, when certainly lay people like me had no idea that irresponsible bankers were lending billions and trillions of dollars and pounds and euros and yen to people that manifestly would never be able to pay it back. Okay, I wasn't aware of that. And I can guarantee you that there wasn't a police officer in the land would have been aware of that at the time. So when they walked in to the offices of Alistair's, which were, you know, after his murder, I can guarantee you that the police would have regarded the bank as being every part of the establishment. And the police would have been utterly deferential. And they might even have bowed and scraped a little bit. And they actually, and I know this firsthand, because Alistair's partner, business partner at the bank, excuse me, gave me a long interview. I know the police went in there, and when it came to access to files and information from the bank, they got what they were given. They got what the bank wanted them to see. Whereas if it had been me, in the unlikely event that I'd turned up on the Monday, the 29th of November, 2004, I can tell you I'd have gone, right, this department is shut. Nobody touch anything. If you do, I'm arresting you for perverting the course of justice. Nobody tap the keyboard. Nobody log on. Nobody do anything. I am having all of this. This department of the bank is shut down. All the hardware and the software is seized until we get the answers that we need. But that didn't happen. They brought in officers from the drug squad to go and sit with employees from the bank, who then told them how complex lending arrangements worked. What a nonsense. I was a knuckle-dragging, bone-headed drug squad officer, and I couldn't think of anybody less qualified to deal with complex financial matters, either then or now, than myself. It's a lunatic situation. So they got told what the bank wanted them to know. And I bet the bank knew that they had lots of grubby little secrets. And you know what? That's why Lloyds Bank, as they are now, won't answer any of my questions. Not one. And some of them are so perfectly reasonable. And that's why I've been called up twice to the Houses of Parliament to meet the all-party parliamentary group on business banking. And they are out enraged by some of the tactics that Lloyds Bank and its very clever, expensive lawyers pull. They'll do anything to stop the truth coming out, these people. They are robbers in suits. I'd rather a bloke with a stocking over his head and a sawn-off shotgun. At least you know you stand with where you stand with people like that. Not these robbers in suits. And it's because of their secrets that we will probably never find out the truth. And therefore, Alistair, the man who killed Alistair, will never be caught. And so therefore, Veronica and Alistair's two mighty fine young men, you know, who are now young men, will not get the justice they so desperately crave.
Well, there's other fallout as well then, isn't there, really? If you, you know, if you're viewing the fact that Alistair was probably relatively small fry in regards to some of these financial ongoings, they still can't link anything to him. But obviously, from all the evidence that you've managed to put together, it does look like that's something that's likely to have been the case. I mean, think of all the other ongoings within the financial world, within that business. How many other people have fallen out of public sight?
There's a brilliant example in my book, okay, of Lyndon Scowfield and all his crooked, bent, corrupt mates out in Reading, and the millions and millions that they got through their illegal financial trickery, robbing people of their homes, their livelihoods, their pensions, their futures. And these were people that were Bank of Scotland employees, right? And you and Lloyds and the Bank of Scotland have done everything they possibly can do to obstruct people along the way who want to know the truth. They're nothing. They're no better than bank robbers, these people. They really aren't.
It's no shock to us. We've, unfortunately, some of the projects that we've had to work on have been as a result of the banks being forced to rectify wrongs that they've done. And it's literally taken legal cases, stepping in from the regulators, and a huge heap of terrible publicity. And even then, being on the inside, you can tell that they're only willing to do as much as they really have to. And if there's any way to get away with any of it, they will.
Yeah, the bare minimum. And we bailed them out with our taxes. What a nonsense. I'd have let them all go to the wall. But anyway, that's not what we're here to discuss, is it?
It's all right. We're here to set the world straight. Come on, Peter, let's do this.
But yeah, it is a really fascinating case. But like you say, there's so much more to it. And it is a shame, because if it is down to, you know, people refusing to let the skeletons out of the closet, then, you know, Alistair's wife and children are never going to get justice. You know, it's, we're relying on that information coming out, or people coming forward in order to get the information to, you know, to basically, you know, bring the case to justice and solve it, essentially. So,
to be fair, though, Joanna, would you want to come forward and let the skeletons out your closet if the last guy that was involved was shot dead on his doorstep? Takes some pretty big balls for some of the people to have come forward and speak to you, you know, throughout these years.
But the gunman wasn't alone. I'm convinced of that. I'm utterly convinced there was someone laying in wait in a vehicle. And again, I explain it in the book because of the route that was taken up to Seabank Road where the weapon was dropped, and down the drain and all of that. I'm sure there was somebody else at the wheel. And who knows, you know, people, okay, it's rare, but sometimes people's conscience do get pricked.
Or allegiances change.
Yeah, and that, well, that's what the old Bill always say, isn't it? You know, more in hope than friggin', you know, than anything else. But they do from time to time. They do, but they're rarities. Yeah, let's just hope at some point. And of course, for Veronica and the boys, but also for the people of Nairn, because it is still a stain on that wonderful, wonderful place. And please, if you ever get the opportunity, go to Nairn. Right? It's great. And give me a bell and let me know if you're going. My picture of Nairn, I'm pointing to it now, is on my wall, right? It's a print of the bandstand and the links that lead down to the beach and all of that. And it's kind of, was painted not very far from where, Alistair's house is. I love Nairn. I love the people of Nairn. Well, I love Scotland per se, but the people of Nairn have been so accommodating to me over the years. Really, really lovely. And I owe them them apology because I said I would always try to get a major documentary series on the murder of Alistair made. And I've clearly thus far failed to do that. But it's a great place. And just for, if you're like me, you're not from Scotland and you go there and you want to eat something with cream and jam on it, don't ask for a scone, right? It's a scone as in gone, not a scone as in own.
You'll get thrown at you, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I did duck, but I learned very quickly, right? It's a scone as in gone.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Peter, for being with us to discuss this case. Absolutely fantastic. If you could, for us, just tell us again a little bit about your book, just because I reckon it will be of interest to our readers. They might want to pick it up and have a read. So if you could just close us off with a little summary of your book, that'd be grand.
Thank you. My book about my research into the murder of Alistair Wilson is called To Catch a Killer. It's available on Amazon and in other bookshops. If you live near an independent bookshop that you support, kindly ask them to order it in, and that would be great. But yes, To Catch a Killer by Peter Blexley. Thank you.